follow the visualization now that Swamiji has given us for this lesson. The purpose of this visualization is for us to understand that money is merely a flow of energy. And even though we exemplify it, we personify it as a thing unto itself, it's really a flow of energy. So the image of financial abundance that we are focusing on is literally a flow of gold, the purest and the most beautiful form of financial abundance is gold. Visualize, Swami suggests, literally a flow of gold coins just coming down like a waterfall from an infinite source. Gold is a beautiful material. It's pure, it glistens, it has weight and substance, it's mutable. To see this waterfall of beautiful gold just pouring down upon us. And see as that cascade forms around us, that it changes from solid matter into liquid light. See the gold coming down from a higher source and manifesting all around us as this golden liquid light, this pouring gold of liquid light. Feel ourselves literally surrounded, bathed, encompassed by this limitless waterfall of gold and golden light. Feel that that flow of energy is unlimited, that nothing stands between us and that unlimited abundance. Inwardly imagine yourself holding out your hands and your arms and having this golden liquid substance just pour over us. See how beautiful it is. Beautiful in itself, and beautiful for the flow of energy it represents and for the possibilities of good that that flow of abundance can do in the world through us. Feel that this very universe is showering abundance upon us, that this golden liquid of financial abundance is our very own, given to us by God to serve His work in this world, to do good, to support good causes, to express the goodness within us. Feel that there's no separation between ourselves and that this limitless waterfall of liquid gold. See our little self as part of this infinite flow. Feel the smallness of our own capacities dissolving into the infinite capacities of the divine. All sense of littleness, of limitation, is being absorbed into that golden flow as we find ourselves as we truly are, which is one with that infinite spirit. Now please repeat after me. Thy wealth flows into me.
Thy wealth flows into me.
And through me.
And through me.
Its strength and power of accomplishment.
Its strength and power of accomplishment.
Are unlimited. For thou art infinite. Thy power within me is infinite.
Thy power within me is infinite.
Thy wealth flows into me and through me.
Thy wealth flows into me and through me.
Its strength and power of accomplishment.
Its strength and power of accomplishment.
Are unlimited.
Are unlimited.
For thou art infinite.
For thou art infinite.
Thy power within me is infinite. Thy wealth flows into me and through me. Its strength and power of accomplishment are unlimited, for thou art infinite. Thy power within me is infinite. Now repeat it silently as I read it. Thy wealth flows into me and through me. Its strength and power of accomplishment are unlimited, for thou art infinite. Thy power within me is infinite. Om peace. Amen. Before we start on lesson two, we finally finished lesson one. Are there any questions or lingering thoughts that we need to cover before we go on to the lesson number two of 26 here? Anything? I know we've had a whole week break, and so you might not be as focused in on it as we have been. A lot happens in a week. Okay. I'm amazed that we're on lesson two, finally. And I'm very interested that lesson number one is called Dharma is the Key to Success, and lesson number two is called How to Magnetize Money. I think Swamiji just decided we might as well go right where we were going. The visualization that he offers us, you know, visualizing ourselves being showered with gold coins, is about as explicit as you can get. But it's very interesting how, again, how obliquely, in a sense, he approaches this. And this is what we're studying this course, is trying to really deeply understand success magnetism as Swami Kriyananda has lived it and as he teaches it. And it's really a step outside of what most courses on prosperity are about. A friend of mine who actually used to be associated with, I think his name is Tony Robbins, she's been listening to these lessons online, and she commented to me, gee, this course certainly picks it up from a different angle. You're talking about an awful lot of stuff that people don't usually talk about when they talk about this subject. Usually we talk a lot more about our desires and how we're going to fill them and how we're worthy of fulfilling them and how we deserve to have all these things and big pictures of material things and, boats and big houses and big bank accounts and lots of trips and private jets and fancy clothes and that sort of like. We ground our attempts to manifest in the things that we want to manifest. What Swamiji is proposing to us here is that if we learn how to have the consciousness that we imagine those things will bring us, that we may have whatever we choose, if we choose to have it, but we'll have really what it is that we deeply desire behind it. Somebody this last week at Spiritual Renewal at Ananda Village quoted a statement from Master that I hadn't heard before, which I thought was wonderful. He says, the purpose of success is learning to live the way you need to be able to live in order to be a success. And then when you have success, what you will have actually accomplished is that you have learned how to have right consciousness. And when you have right consciousness, then everything else follows naturally from that. Now, I'm not really trying to trick you. Because the other side of this, which I have to emphasize repeatedly, is that this course really has come out of Swami Kriyananda's actual experience. And his capacity to manifest is extraordinary. And I use this example as I talked when I was introducing this course. He was 36 years old. He was completely friendless. He was alone. He had virtually no money. And with nothing except right consciousness, he's created a worldwide spiritual organization, and he's done it step by step by the power of his own magnetism with a conscious using of these principles. And I was speaking to a friend about teaching this course, and I said, I'm just deeply desirous of really understanding inside my own self how he did it. Because one, all of us have a need to be able to manifest what we need. I mentioned also in Yogananda's book, How to Be Happy All the Time. It's a surprise. It's surprising how much of that book is about money, because money becomes usually the lack of it, seldom the excess of it, although sometimes that does also wipe out people's happiness. But the lack of it causes an enormous amount of stress for people. And we also have this feeling that we're being forced to do all these things for money. And so it becomes the fulcrum point of our, for a lot of people, happiness and sadness. So it's a very valuable thing to learn to manifest. Plus, it is our own nature to have infinite abundance. And this is the point that this lesson is really beginning to try to emphasize. How to manifest money is to recognize our unity with that infinite power. And what keeps us from being able to manifest that infinite abundance is because we have this mindset that we cling to that says that's not who we are. Now, one of the other things that's going to distinguish this course from others that you may take is that we're not going to give you the false promise of a big emotional experience. You know, Swami Kriyananda, I've noticed, I've observed very carefully over the years, he absolutely refuses to trade in personality or to trade in emotional highs, so to speak. When I've heard him speak, I think of him speaking right here. Sometimes he's almost deliberately, bland is not the right word, but he deliberately just puts out a very, very clean and straight vibration. And if you want to tune into him, you have to sort of calm down and go into the center of that vibration. He doesn't do a lot of sort of whipping people's enthusiasm up. And a lot of times we imagine that if we can get excited enough about an idea, that that's the same as actually changing our consciousness into it. Swami, in his book, a book of aphorisms he just published, said that emotional revelations are like pictures with a still camera. He said you can take the picture, you freeze it in that moment, but time changes and everything goes on, and that's a moment frozen in time. It's not a moving reality, as opposed to a film which takes things as they're evolving and as they're happening. So we have this idea, I've overcome that fear, I've overcome this limitation, I've overcome this idea, I accept that I will be whatever I'm going to be. But then after a while, we can remember maybe that we had that experience, but we can't grasp it anymore because it's fundamentally ephemeral if it's created by a great deal of external excitement. The kind of change that self-realization, that the practice of Kriya Yoga, which is what we're doing here, whether or not you're formally practicing Kriya or not, this whole approach to life is the Kriya Yoga path, is a path about inward transformation. Not merely a moment, not merely a peak, but an actual reorganizing and rearranging of the fundamental magnetism within us. And this is what Swamiji is talking about in this particular chapter. I know I characterized it in our last class by saying essentially what he says is you can manifest money. All you have to do is eliminate your inner blocks. And his advice for eliminating them is just get over it, just like that. You know, there's not a lot of energy given here to process. Swami himself often from time to time will sort of ask about what is it that people mean when they say they are processing? He'll sort of ask as if he were from another planet. Especially the phrase he likes is processing a lot of stuff, is the phrase that he'll hear. And then he'll sort of ask me, you know, what could he be talking about? But it is like a foreigner looking in, you know, from a reality that he's long since transcended. So Swami starts this whole lesson called Manifesting Money. He just sort of starts with a rather dismissive, money is a thing merely, a medium of exchange. We give it energy by the expectations we project upon it. And I guess that's why he has us bathing ourselves in gold coins in our visualization, that it's just a thing, but what we project upon it, what we imagine is going to come to us through the possession of money is what is really drawing us all the time. But of course, the things that we expect and need, we actually need. You know, we need to be able to pay our rent. It is the medium of exchange. We have to buy food. Occasionally, we would like to do something frivolous. If we wish to travel, if we wish to help, you know, a good cause, it all becomes necessary. But what he's trying to get us started in understanding is that it's really the energy we imagine that we can project if we have money that is what we're really striving for. You know, we want the security of being able to take care of ourselves. We want the satisfaction of being able to take care of those who depend on us. We want the fulfillment of helping a cause that we believe in. And it's that flow of energy that's really attractive to us. That's the expectation we're putting out. There are people who literally like money, but they are few and far between. Many, many years ago, I bought a used car. And at that time, I lived on a cash economy. And we bought this car from I think he just was born to be a used car salesman. He was just like, if you had gone to Central Casting and asked for a used car salesman, this man could not have been more perfect. The entire time he helped us, he wore those kinds of sunglasses where you can't see his eyes but only your own reflection back. He actually had a cigar. And he was completely uninterested, really, in us. Now, this is a good one. I think this one would probably work for you. This is the car. You know, you can have this one. This will be a good deal. Yeah, I would recommend that one over this one. Yeah, I think that's a good one. Sure, if that's what you want, you can have it. Just kind of that energy. And then when we literally pulled out the cash, he took off his glasses. He became very enthusiastic. He took it in his hands and he had all this dynamic energy that we had seen none of until that moment. I'd never in my life even imagined that such people existed. He was like King Midas, you know, in his throne. And he counted it and he put it in his, you know, here and there and everywhere. And there you are. I just thought, there but for the grace of God, you know. Or there have I been in some lifetime or another. All that he projected, you know, just by literally having that money in his hand. Now, the fact of shifting our intentions, and this is Swami talks about this in this lesson, we'll deal with it a little bit in a moment, from the form of what we're attracted to the energy behind it, and even more than that, to the consciousness behind it, is the secret of really all success in life. I'll give you sort of an example of how this is, just so you can understand what it's like. When I was a young person, before I found Swamiji, before I found the spiritual path, I always had, let me put it differently. When I found myself living in a spiritual community dedicated to God, you know, following a spiritual path, doing all these things, on one level I was quite astonished that this is how my life had ended up. Because growing up, there was no hint of it. I grew up in a very conventional family, and there was just no idea that I would take such a radical course. We were Jewish, and there was just no such thing really as a religious order or a religious life. I could have been a scholarly rabbi, but even that was just so far beyond the pale that when I actually found myself where I ended up in my early 20s, I was just astonished that it had happened like this. And then I looked back, and it was very interesting for me to realize that, in fact, from the earliest age, what I had wanted for my life had always been exactly the same. And it was completely consistent with where I ended up. But I just kept altering the form as I became more subtle in my understanding. What I really longed for, I used to call it being happy, which was a good way to put it. But I also, what I felt was this extraordinary sense of inner confinement. You know, I just felt so confined. I didn't have the sophistication as a young child to articulate it like that. But I would look at the world, literally, I would look out the window of my parents' house, and it would all just feel so small. And I just couldn't see myself fitting into any of those places, you know, have a family, have a house, have a car. In fact, my greatest fear was that I would marry a dentist and end up with a station wagon and a dog and quite a few, you know, children in a car. It was like a living nightmare to me when I would see these women driving along in these cars, because I could just somehow imagine that life could just suck me down that road and I just end up down that road. I did, however, have a strong desire for human love. And that for a while also translated into the idea that I would have children and that I would, you know, run this beautiful family. We wouldn't have the station wagon and we wouldn't have the dog. Somehow it had a more expansive view to it. I was not practical in my thinking. But I did want. But when I began to come to the spiritual path, I began to understand that what I was seeking was self-expansion. And I thought, well, I can expand from being single to being married, and then I'll have doubled, you know, and then we'll produce children, and then, you know, there'll be sort of a geometric progression here. We'll have lots of children, and then we'll feel really large. And at some point in all of that process, it occurred to me that it would never feel like I thought it was going to feel, that I would always still be trapped in my own consciousness. And I remember when I was about 18, 19 maybe, this one night, and I don't know what provoked it at all, but I recall this lying in bed and what felt to me like being awake all night, although I doubt if I really was. And I just kept trying to think if there was anything I could do in an external way that would actually free me from the limitations of my own consciousness. You know, I imagined traveling to outer space, living on other planets, going to other countries, doing daring things as an explorer, you know, being touted as a great success in whatever I decided to do. But in all of them, I could just sense that when I finally got there, my consciousness would still be confined. I almost like inside my head, I would be able to feel the limits of my own self, and therefore it would not be satisfying. Now, I mean, all of that is putting words backwards. But when I finally understood that in fact there was such a thing as the confining identification with the ego, and that that ego could be dissolved, and in the dissolution of that ego, the kind of freedom that I was really longing for could actually come. It was just a straight line to get onto the spiritual path. It was a straight line to become a Kriya Yogi, to become a member of Ananda, to go live out in this, at that time, just very barren piece of land and do this unusual thing. But it was a straight line from my earliest thoughts right to there. But the form of it kept shifting as I understood it more dynamically. And very often when people come to me telling me that this is what they want, I want to be a healer, I want to be married, you know, I want to have a college degree, I want to make money, whatever it might be, I often ask them exactly what Swamiji is asking us here. What is it that you think that will feel like? What does that represent to you? And people will say, often the common one I hear is, I want to be a healer. And then they're telling me they're going to do this and this and this. So what does that mean? Well, that means I want to help people. Well, do you think that there's anybody around you that you could start helping right now? You know, can you imagine that you could take what it is that you think will happen in the future and begin to express some piece of it now? What will happen if you have a marriage partner? Well, then I'll have somebody to love. Well, do you think there's anybody in your life that you could start loving right now? You know, what is preventing you from expressing that experience? It's only that we have these forms in our mind. And we think that unless I have that form, I can't have that consciousness. But you see, fundamentally, in itself, that's a delusion. Because consciousness, all forms of consciousness, are accessible to us right now. And we profoundly limit our life experience by allowing our consciousness to be defined by the external realities we're living in. And so Swamiji, just to skip ahead a little bit, whenever he talks about manifesting, and long before he wrote this course, he would always say this to us, you know, he teaches exactly the opposite of what many others teach. Many others teach that you have to be very precise. And people will tell me proudly, I, you know, picked out the color of the car and I knew what the interior would be and that's exactly the car that I have. And I'm glad they have that car, but I can't help but wonder how much genuine happiness they're having from it. I know I've shared with all of you when David and I went through this huge effort to get just exactly the right color carpet for this apartment that we had before the one we have now. We just decided we wanted the whole apartment to be in light golden colors, and turns out getting a light golden colored carpet was not simple. We thought it was a simple thing. It turned out not to be, and we stuck with it till we got it, and it was delivered from across the country, and it was hauled in, and it was laid down, and finally, ta-da, there's the whole apartment covered in this carpet. And the pleasure of it was so small. I mean, it was just so amazingly small. I did everything I could to try to squeeze as much pleasure as I possibly could out of it. You know, I stretched myself out on it. I looked at it from all angles, and then I just got up and went about my business, you know. It's just not there. First of all, it's an inanimate object, and it can't love you back. Was its biggest problem. It just sat there and really never cared about me, no matter how much I cared about it. It just sat there. There was nothing alive about it. But so often, we are, for one reason or another, I was starting to say, Swami, many people say, be very exact. And Swami actually, he does say that we should be very exact. But what we should be very exact about is the consciousness we want to experience, the energy we want to project. We need to feel that very dynamically and be very, very in tune with that, and then leave the rest of it to manifest itself in whatever way that consciousness and energy will actually want to manifest. See, part of it is we live on this side of that actual consciousness, and we think, oh, that's the form it should take. That's the form it should take. And so then we take the consciousness we presently have, and we demand that form. But then all we ever have is the same consciousness we have, you see? Because we've just projected it onto the form we think we want. If instead we raise our consciousness to a higher vibration, we raise our energy to a more dynamic, more selflessly directed, as we'll talk about in a moment, form of energy, and then let that energy and consciousness manifest the right form for us, you see how much more open-ended that is? That's where Swami tells the story about the man in the, being shown around the heavenly junkyard and being shown this beautiful big car that someone on earth rejected. He says, who would reject that car? And the man says, well, of course you did. This is all just a funny story. Why would I reject that car? I would love to have that car. It's, well, every time you visualized a car, you just visualized a little Volkswagen. So this big Mercedes could never be given to you because you defined the form by the energy that you had at the present moment. Now, this is where we go back, and this is again how I'm saying how Swami's approaching this so differently. He's emphasizing to us over and over again that the entire nature of the material world is that matter is vibration of energy, and energy is a vibration of consciousness. So if we're trying to have anything in the material world, if we just bang around in the material world, we're not really working with the cause. Even if, by the power of our will, we can focus on whatever that particular picture is and bring it to bear, how limited that is compared to learning to direct energy with the right consciousness, because then the form will always take care of itself. You see? And you see, also, once you have that capacity, nothing in your life, not even death, can take it away from you. Because you can lose every form there is, but if you have energy and consciousness, it will be no obstacle to you. Because the difficulty with laying our hopes on any form of anything is that forms are impermanent. We had the experience, it was now many years ago at Ananda Village, of having this forest fire. When I lived up there, it was 1976. It was June of 1976. We'd had 7 years of drought in California, and a fire started just in such a way that the wind was behind it, and it blew up the hill, and it came to the community that we had so laboriously built over the last 5 or 6 years, and in a matter of hours burned down a great many of the buildings, burned down mostly the houses in a certain section. Parts of it were completely spared, and the main buildings were spared, but like 21 houses were burned to the ground. Some of them were no great shakes as buildings, but it didn't matter. They were all we had, and they went to ashes. It was a remarkable experience, and even though it happened a long time ago, I personally didn't lose my house such as it was, which was this tiny travel trailer, but it was all I had. But it was quite something in a matter of just a very short period of time to see the material world go to ash. You know, we sort of know that as a kind of theoretical possibility, but to really just be standing there, and we were up, I laugh, we were up on Rajasi Ridge, which is the hilltop there, and we were standing on that ridge, and we were watching the fire burn up toward us, and we were prepared for a forest fire, because we're used to it in that area, and somebody had gotten us all these little cotton shirts, and so we're all dressed in these mandarin-collared, long-sleeved blue cotton things, which made us look very oriental, and we had these little hand tools, and so we were all up there, and it really looked like the Vietnam War to us, because we were all dressed the same in these little oriental pajama things, and we're working up there, and the fire is coming up, and we're scratching a fire line, as we've all been trained to do, and so we're scratching all the grass away from the wide road up there, and the fire just came. Fortunately, it was just grass at that point, but it just came right up to the grass. It kind of saw our fire line. It chuckled a little. It just chuckled, and then it just jumped right over. So all of a sudden, those of us standing on the road had fire on two sides of us, and we were not really, really stupid, so we ran away from there really fast, just ran down the hill. But just before that, we watched, and all the houses, then there was hardly any brush clearing, and all the houses were in this very forested area, and we watched the grass fire go to the base of those trees, and because it had been so dry for so long, we watched the fire shoot up. Fire moves very fast when the wind is behind it. We watched it shoot up to the top of the tree, and then we watched it do what they call tree topping, which it just started going across. And it was just, you know, flames were engulfing the place where all the houses were. And there we were. You know, these things don't happen to people, to us. They happen to others. And we just ran off that hill and started emptying out what then was the publications building, which is now Hansa Temple, for those of you who know it, which is halfway up at the hill there. We started emptying it out. I was in charge, just dragged a bunch of cars there, huge billowing smoke, and we start pulling days of before computers. So we were pulling out the original files on the, we couldn't get much inventory out, but the, to take the mailing list out so that we could read that. And I just remember, and I shouted to them, and then there was this press that weighed about 5,000 pounds, and I actually insisted that we try to push it, you know, a little bit, but then people persuaded me that was insane. So we just took everything that we would need to keep going and drove it down the hill. Then the whole hill was enveloped in smoke, I mean, thick, dark, greasy smoke, and we didn't have any idea what had been burned. We were way down at the lowest point, basically with all the children and you're going to have to drive farther off the path. But I came up the hill and all the landmarks were burned, and I just was wandering around, and I finally realized that I just didn't even know where I was in my own home, because it was all so completely different. Now, it's a very marvelous thing to meditate on, and all the people who went through it in a positive way feel greatly blessed by it, even if they have no pictures of their children from a certain age backwards, because they all went to ashes. It really helps you appreciate what is it that I'm really attached to. And that, for that, for us there, what happened to us was everyone who thought that Ananda was a physical place left. And everyone who understood that Ananda was a state of mind and a consciousness stayed. And it was a very helpful thing, because people thought our community had burned down. There's no place left to live. Others of us thought the houses and the trees have burned down, you know, but this is our home. Where would we go? And I remember, in fact, running up the hill to the publications building and saying to the person next to me, take the mailing list first, because that's what we're going to need to rebuild. And I did. I went right in. Then it was metal plates. I mean, that's how long ago this was. We had to just pick up these big metal plates and the machine that went with it. And it was the first thing I took out, because I knew it was the first thing we'd need. Now, what Swamiji is talking about here is that the closer we bring our intention to the origin of our being, the more powerful that intention will be. The more peripheral that intention is, just by self-evidently, you're working at the edge of your being, you can't really draw the power that is really your own potential into effect. And there's also a factor which is God will not necessarily want to help you as much. There's an incredible statement in here which I just found so compelling. And it's the comment about, let me just see if I can find it here. People don't realize that faith simply means working with an energy and a will that are already there. There is a subtle power in the universe that we can lock into, like plugging an electric cord into a wall socket. An all-important point to consider is motivation. When one does anything with ulterior motives, he dissipates his energy by pretending to be doing a thing while really doing or wanting something else. Now, Swami goes on, and I will go on to talk more about that. But I love that thought. Few people realize that faith is merely cooperating with a flow of energy and a will that is already there. Now, the difficulty is that we very often want to use that energy, but we want to use it for a purpose that God did not intend, in a sense. You know, there was a friend of mine who had a note in her car that says, "Everything that happens is an expression of God's love for us." Turned out it was a quote from me, from a class that I'd given, because I commented and I said, "That's a wonderful statement." She says, "Well, I got that off one of your tapes. Oh, I'm so pleased that I said that." But then she looked at me and she said, "Do you think it's really true?" And being fresh from this, studying this course, I was thinking about how Swamiji had described karma in the first lesson. And he was saying, everything that happens is given to us to draw us to a deeper understanding of where our true happiness comes from. And every obstacle that we meet in life, we meet that obstacle because in some way we haven't understood where our true happiness comes from. And so God is trying to teach us where happiness comes from. And how can that be anything but an act of love? If it's an investment in our future happiness, this is the way parents treat their children, isn't it? Children don't always appreciate it, don't always really see, and parents are not always wise. Sometimes they're acting more from their own self-interest than from the genuine interest of the children. But with pure wisdom, you see how it actually works. Now, in our efforts to manifest, we may be able to exert enough egoic power to bring into manifestation something we merely want. And God may even help us to manifest it for a very interesting reason, which is we learn, Swamiji says, from being frustrated, but we learn more from having our desires fulfilled. Because as long as our desire, we have a desire for something and it's not fulfilled, we will always be able to imagine that if I only had it, then I would be happy. And that's why, oddly enough, there are more suicides among really wealthy people than there are among really poor people. We look at really poor people and think their conditions are so terrible, they must want to kill themselves. But the fact is, if you're very poor, you can always imagine, if I can just change my circumstances, then I'll feel better. But those in the world who have everything and still are not fulfilled, then the desire simply to take your own life is often irresistible. Because what is there left to live for? So often if we have this strong desire for whatever it might be, even just to be wealthy or to experience some great luxuries in life, if that desire is really strong within us, God won't necessarily thwart it. Especially if we're willing to put out the energy and sort of live in the way that's necessary to manifest, to channel energy to make that happen. Because then when we have it, when we hold it in our hands, when we live through that experience, then we'll be able to understand how much happiness it does or does not give us. In fact, Master made this very startling statement that everything that you no longer desire to do or to have is only because you've already had it. And when you think about all the things that we no longer want, and a lot of them quite negative, you know, to be murderers, to be bigamists, to be thieves, to be president of the United States, whatever it might be, to have governmental power, all these different things. Master said the only reason we no longer want them is because having already experienced them and having tested that as the road to happiness, we no longer want to go down it anymore. So you see how very complex our karmic pattern can be. Now, what Swamiji talks about in here, and this is one of the more interesting points of this, is he's saying that, first of all, he's talking about this one-pointed energy that's required in order for us to really magnetize success. And he talks about how, you know, the blocks to that, like doubt and fear and certain kinds of confusion, and this is the statements that I've been joking about where he just simply says, get over it. He says, you know, look into yourself and feel what's blocking your energy. But the key he gives us, he says, is that the answer you will find is always related to universal principles. There's a very, very deep and complicated teaching that Swamiji is giving in a very simple way here. Now, most psychological approaches to personal health and well-being are all based on the fact that our particular problems are extremely individualized, and what we need to do is we need to understand what happened to me, what motivated me, what were the conditions of my life, how did I grow up, how did my mother treat me, what did I respond to that? And what happens is our energy becomes more and more focused inwardly on ourselves and our own private reality. Now, there is a certain place for that kind of personal understanding. The way I put it to people is that if you are a complete mystery to yourself, if you really have no idea why you feel anything or even what you feel or where any of your attitudes and feelings come from, there is a necessity to become acquainted with yourself. If you're also terrified to admit to what you actually feel or think or have experienced, there's a certain benefit to really exploring those realities. But there comes a certain point where Swami describes here where it's really just a question of whether the energy that goes inward can go either inward and downward, is how he describes it, where we become more and more involved, in essence, in the lower chakras, which represent our commitment to ourselves as separate egos, our commitment to our identification with this physical body. You know, so much of what we think of as ourself, if we actually think about it, are the conditions created by having inhabited this particular body. You know, the mother and father I had, the conditions that I went through as a child, the desires, the experiences, the thwarted hopes, whatever it might be. But it's all based on having lived in this particular body. And so we can sometimes take that energy, and the more inward it gets, the more downward it goes. Swami describes the paradox of inward energy not being expansive versus inward energy that goes inward and upward. In other words, we pull our thoughts away from this material world deeper into who I am inside, but instead of personalizing that, we raise it up and universalize it. Now, the entire key to manifesting that Swami's putting in front of us now is that we get into that energy and that will that already exists. You know, this is our sitting there feeling this golden flow, and that we're not separate from that. That's really part of who we are. Now, simultaneously, he sets up this reality. The little self really can't accomplish very much. But the little self working as an expression of the infinite can accomplish infinitely. And that's the transfer point that we have to be able to make. And this is where Swamiji then starts talking in very, very broad strokes. He talks about karmic patterns that we've set up from wrong actions in the past that are just acting to direct our energy away from where we want to go, giving us lack of success magnetism or blocking our ability to tune into that infinite. And that we can counteract that karma by a conscientious effort of energy and will simply to create an alternative flow. Now, the way I've thought about this a lot myself is like this. There's a certain point in our lives where all the specifics of our karma seem real interesting to us. And then there's a point where I describe it that all karma becomes generic in the sense that it's either going in the right direction or it's not. And it really makes a very little difference why it's going in the wrong direction, because the solution to it is always going to be the same. It's always going to be to set up a counter wave that will set a new pattern for us. And why and how and who it ever got going this direction doesn't matter. All that matters is that from this point forward, we put out the kind of energy that we wish to have in the future. Okay? Now, I'm going to take a short break, and then we will go on with this. Okay? In the first lesson, we just talked a lot about how everything that happens is exactly karmically appropriate. And that was what we went over and over and over again. Okay, so it's karmically appropriate. That's all nice to hear. But the real point is, what if we don't like it? You know, what if it's karmically appropriate, but it's not what we're looking for? So this lesson number two is just in very simple terms, and I want us to not miss how simple this is. Okay, here's what you do about it. We have set in motion whatever we're experiencing at this present moment is the net result of the energies and actions we've taken in the past. Nothing is fixed. This is all just energy playing against itself. This is all forces of magnetism playing against ourselves. You really need to meditate on picturing that as powerfully as you can. And this is why Swami keeps coming back to these points. There's no fixed reality to this world. It's just energy patterns, and those energy patterns are created by consciousness and thought. So if you're sick, if you're well, if you're wealthy, if you're poor, if you're addicted, if you're not addicted, if you have great success magnetism, if you have seem to that nothing goes right for you, all we're talking about is a pattern of energy that creates a magnetic force that draws to it certain conditions. And it keeps drawing those conditions to us because in one way or another, that magnetism keeps spinning in the same way. If you can counter that magnetism with a different force, then all of a sudden what will be drawn to you will be entirely different. And the entire point of energy and magnetism is just simply whatever is stronger takes up what is weaker than itself. And when we talk about the chakras, we describe it by a river flowing and the idea of whirlpools coming off of that flow of a river. And I find that to be one of the clearest ways to see it. If you have a flow of water in a certain direction, and there's a whirlpool on this side, depending on the strength of whatever is in the center of that whirlpool, it will deflect the forward motion of this energy into itself, and that water will spin. For example, we want to be able to work hard and diligently at a certain project, and we get started doing it, but we have this habit of laziness, where we're always thinking that I would be more comfortable if I just didn't have to work so hard. Oh, really, why do I have to work so hard? If I just hadn't been so unfortunate in my parentage. Other people have inheritances. I don't have any inheritance. It's just such a bother. What's the point? So the energy is heading out this way, and then there's a vortex of energy on this side that persuades us that maybe we shouldn't go there. And so a lot of the energy is deflected this way. A little energy goes this direction. Or just laziness, lack of, you know, insecurity. I'm afraid I don't know what I'm doing. What if I might fail? All of these things which pull our energy inward and downward. Invariably, what breaks the flow of energy is some kind of self-concern. Usually a self-concern that's contractive. Isn't that so? I mean, when we have an expansive energy. And now, the other thing is what often motivates us and really gives us energy is when we're committed to some ideal or goal that takes our minds off ourselves. Isn't that true? When I first moved to Ananda Village in the summer of 1971, I had a great interest in nutrition, and I was a fanatical diet person about diet. I couldn't really cook, which was a bit of a problem when I actually ended up being in charge of the kitchen, but I knew a lot about food, and I was interested in food. But I was asked to go in as a volunteer to assist this older woman who was very skilled at running the kitchen. She had a family emergency and left town in the middle of the night. And within a few weeks, I was in charge of the whole kitchen, which was really hard on the people there because I was such a terrible cook. So we had about 4 or 5 months until there was like a little revolt within the community. And then Swamiji basically took me over to his house for a weekend had me come to his house for the weekend while he was hosting this other man, and he taught me to cook. I mean, that's how he said it, I'm going to teach you to cook. I don't know how he taught me to cook, but on Monday morning I knew how to cook. I knew how to make food taste good, and I knew how to work with it, and I've been a very good cook ever since. It was a very peculiar but quite essential thing he had to do because there I was in charge in the. And it was at a time in the early years where people didn't have individual homes. I was up at the meditation retreat. There were 30 or 40 people there. Nobody had their own kitchen. They took all their meals in the kitchen where I was cooking, and they were dying. And so in order to save the community, he had to shift my consciousness, which he did somehow. He shifted my consciousness. He woke up something that was in me that was there to be woken up. Now, let's see, where was I in all of that? Why did I start there? Oh, yes. But when I ended up being in charge of that kitchen, I had to cook 3 meals a day, 6 days a week for about 40 people. I had one assistant And she was not entirely mentally competent. She was a nice person, but her brain didn't work entirely in a normal manner. And then on the seventh day, I had to go to town and fill the truck with supplies for the other days. And this was all through the winters. We lived way up in the, way back in the mountain roads there, and unpaved roads. We'd have the rain and the snow and the sleet. And for the first beginning of it, we didn't even have a four-wheel drive vehicle. So I would load this truck up, and we would just get it as far as we could get. And then it would invariably fall off into the ditch. And if we weren't able to get it up the hill that night, then we'd have to truck all the supplies up with. I mean, it was a big deal. I loved it, every minute of it. But I didn't have any time for anything else. And I certainly didn't have any time to stop and think about whether I wanted to do it or not. Of course, I did want to do it. I thought every part of it, you know, even the most ridiculous and awful parts of it, were absolutely fun from start to finish. Oh, did I mention that the kitchen leaked so much that sometimes when I would come in, there would literally be a couple of inches of water all over the counters? Once I walked up in the middle of the winter, this was this dome that we had, the kitchen that we only tore down a few years ago. It was an absolute piece of trash in 1970, and we used it until the 90s. I walked up to it one day, and it was this white dome, and it had the most beautiful pattern of icicles all the way around the base. And it had been snowing and cold, and I thought, wow, I'd never noticed that beautiful pattern of icicles. Gosh, I'm so unobservant. And that was because the pipes had burst and the water had run out. And the reason I'd never seen it before is that exact thing hadn't happened before, which is just, so there I was. And so I had to get water, I had to carry big basins over to the bathhouse, which was about 25 yards away, and just fill the water buckets up and bring them back. I was very, very strong. And just, you know, carrying all the water. That was just part of what we had to do in order to live there. But what I learned at that time, and I learned it really well in a way that I've never forgotten, is how much fun it is to not worry about yourself. I was just so busy and so focused on the fact that if I didn't cook, these people wouldn't eat. If I didn't shop, they wouldn't have any food. If I didn't figure out a way to deal with the fact that the pipes just burst, you know, I couldn't just say, oh, well, sorry, everybody, no food today because the pipes just burst. You know, they were working hard in their own way, and they needed me to do it. I was like a mother would be with her children, of course. But you know how many times when you ask a woman who's past the age of raising her children, I've been surprised, and my own mother gave me the same answer. What was your happiest time of your life when my children were little? Even though sometimes at the time she wasn't so happy. But one of the reasons that the mother was so happy during that period of time is that she was not concerned about herself. Because the necessity to take care of those children really left very little time to say, what about me? Now, that's one of the best ways that we create a counter wave. We create an expansive, self-offering wave that is not inward and downward and concerned about self. This is the whole principle of what we always call karma yoga or seva. Seva meaning divine service, which is one of the ways in which we can progress spiritually. We speak of three S's. One is sadhana, which it means spiritual practice. One is satsang, which means the company of other truth seekers. And the third point is seva. And seva is service. And that's why we're so often inviting people in the context of Ananda. Would you like to help? Would you like to volunteer? And, you know, the cynical say, oh, they're just trying to get something from me. But that's not true. It's that when we begin to give our energy to a cause greater than ourself, what happens is we begin to discover the joy of having our energy flow in some direction other than self-concern. And the second thing about that is we set up a counter wave of positive wave of giving energy that becomes a magnetic force that begins to draw to us more and more of what we really want. I mean, in the Bible, they actually speak of this exactly. They say, to those who have, more shall be given, and to those who have not, even the little they have shall be taken away from them. I mean, that is a really grim statement, isn't it? You know, that's right there. That's how Jesus describes it. I mean, the words may be slightly different than that, but that's the meaning. And you think how terribly unfair. And so much of our culture is really set up to take those who have nothing and try to give them bunches of stuff. And even in our current, you know, political climate, it's just, quite frankly, well, the rich people are going to pay for the poor people's medical insurance. That's just the way it's going to be. As some commentator or columnist said, he said it's the most blatant redistribution of wealth scheme that this country has ever seen. We'll just take from those people who have something and give it to those who don't. Now, the problem with that is that that doesn't necessarily do anything to reverse the karma of the individual who doesn't have it. And it's not necessarily even appropriate, but that's a whole different... I'm not going to go into politics right here. I had a very interesting experience with Swami Kriyananda, just passed in a moment when we were in Rome just last... whenever we were very recently there, whatever, this is August, so that must have been May, June. There was a man there who was very deformed, and he was on what was essentially a skateboard, like a big sort of skateboard. He was sitting on the skateboard. I don't think he had any legs, and I'm not sure he even had normal arms, and he had a tennis shoe on one of his hands, and he was using it, or maybe he only had an elbow, but he was pushing himself along. So he was a very deformed person right in this square in Rome. You see that kind of thing in India a lot more than you see in Italy, but there he was. And, you know, he was pathetic, and he was begging. And we walked by him. And Kriyananda's response was extremely interesting. He was sort of startled by the sight of him, and he turned to whoever was next to him. I overheard him, and he just said, "He's still just thinking about himself. He's just going to go down and down from there instead of up." Wasn't that amazing? You know, he just like, instead of, he was very concerned for him, but he was mostly concerned for him because the direction of his consciousness was not going to take him up. By contrast, just the way these things are so odd, Rick is smiling because he knows what I'm going to say. In Varanasi, in the city of Benares, where we went on pilgrimage a number of times, there's an old section of the city, which is the bazaar, where the streets are very narrow, and it's thousands of years old. And when you go into that sort of marketplace, you enter this maze. You get lost in there very easily. But there was an entry point. And there was a beggar there who was also so deformed that he was lying on a little platform with wheels. He had the most radiant face. I mean, he just had this blissfully beautiful face that it was sort of odd. You just went by and felt such a sense of uplifting energy, you forgot to give him money. Because it was just like you'd walk by and it was so such a blessing to go by him. I mean, two men in exactly the same condition. Both of them obviously brought to that condition by whatever the karma had been that, you know, made them have to experience that, but two completely different responses to it. When we came out of, there was a documentary many years ago, this was 15 or 20 years ago, a documentary film about Mother Teresa. And I happened to go see it with Swamiji. It happened, we saw it in this area. And when we came out, Swami said, I can say this to you, and I'm saying it to you for the same reason, because I know you won't misunderstand, Swamiji said. But when you looked at some of those people that Mother Teresa was picking up off the street who were dying alone on the street, he said, when you looked at the consciousness in their eyes, you could see how they ended up there. That's a very impersonal thing to say, you know, but it is a fact. Now, what we want to say is whatever condition we find ourselves in that we don't want to be in anymore, we need to very definitely and dynamically put out the right kind of energy to set up the counter wave to that, to as Swami says, deflect the karma and to ultimately reverse it. And all of the difficulties that we face can be overcome by universal principles, because it's always and only just a question of which direction our energy is going. We rationalize it, we justify it. I feel this way because, you know, I've always been this way, and you have to understand I'm dealing with this and this is the reason. And all of that is what we call true but not relevant. Because at the end point, by the time you make all that list of all the reasons why we're justified in just pulling our energy down, sooner or later we're just going to have to pull our energy up. And we might be describing how big the weight is. We might be describing how, as Swamiji says, we need to set a modest goal for ourselves that we can really achieve. And if we recognize that we're carrying a really heavy weight, We might have to be a little more careful about how we expect to be able to turn it, but we need to simplify. And the more I read this lesson, the more I realized that Swami has deliberately taken this and made it so simple so that we won't have a lot of complexity to hold on to. You know, if we see that we're suffering in a particular way, we need to consciously and conscientiously put out the opposite energy. You know, I remember when I was, let me think about how this would go. I remember the first time I read in a spiritual book, and it was one of the very early things I read, "Don't think about yourself and you'll be happy." My first thought was, well, what else is there to think about? It just seemed like such a remarkable idea to me that I would not always be concerned about myself. I thought it was a good thing to be always concerned about myself. I wasn't so much selfish in the sense of ungenerous, is just self-concerned at all times. And I began to appreciate, and this was long after I moved to Ananda, what Swamiji, he says it in here, if your energy is inwardly concerned about your own welfare, you are never one-pointed in your intention, because you are always looking for new opportunities. It's a very interesting sequence, and I understood it perfectly because I realized at a certain point in my life that because I was always self-concerned, I was always evaluating every situation to see how I could use it to bring me something that I wanted. You know, how I could shift my focus to something that would be more fun. I mean, I wasn't an apparently evil person. Part of it was just fun-loving, enjoying good company, you know, doing things that were exciting. But this was a joke between Seva and I one day. Seva is this woman who lives at Ananda Village. She's 12 years older than I. And when I first came to Ananda, she had a position of enormous responsibility in the community. And she and I became best friends. And for like essentially the first decade that I was there, we were almost like Siamese twins. It was sort of a joke. Wherever she was, I was. Wherever I was, she was. We were always together. And she had to take me in hand because I was a mess. And she was a very solid, dutiful person, very serviceful. Her name is Seva. She's very, very serviceful, very focused in her service, very single-minded. And I was just all over the map. And we used to work together in an office, and, you know, the office starting time might have been 9, but on more than one occasion, I didn't get to the office till the afternoon. One day I walked in at 4:30, and I just remember she just said very quietly, "Good morning," like that. And what had happened to me, I mean, I didn't understand till much later, is that all day long I had just been calculating my own position. And every time something came up that looked enjoyable for me to do, and I don't even just mean self-indulgently, but just I was unable to just have a single intention and keep it. Because I was always thinking about myself in those circumstances, and so I could never stay with anything. I was just always seeing how I fit in and doing something else. My temperament was rather buoyant, so mostly I was doing positive things, but often that same self-preoccupation, well, I don't feel like doing this. Well, I have to be sad for a while. Well, I can't do this. Well, he spoke to me in a rude way, and now I have to process it, or whatever it might be. But it's the energy always... what about me? What about me? What about me? And what I saw in Seva, and what I gradually disciplined myself, really I disciplined myself to her consciousness, was just to sort of walk in her wake. Because it was so startling to me to see someone who just set their intention and just went ahead and didn't stop to recalibrate, you know, every 15 minutes to see whether or not how I fit into this. You know, but the energy was just outwardly focused on where we were going and what we were going to do. I began to joke. I said, if I heard that Babaji was giving a satsang up at the meditation retreat, but I had promised Seva I would go to town with her and do her laundry, I would go to town and do her laundry. Because the single most important thing for me became to reverse the direction of that energy. You know, the period of time when I worked in the kitchen was really demanded of me that way. And that's why... because I just didn't have any time. And that's why a lot of time in our lives, it's much better to be very, very busy giving out energy than it is to, quote, have time for ourselves. In fact, specifically, I remember once somebody said to Swami, Seva works too much. She should have more time for herself. Swami rather sternly and definitely said, I'll decide what she needs. Just like that. Because in fact, it was not karmically helpful for her to be given the opportunity to direct the energy back to herself. Because when it went back to herself, it did not go inward and upward. It went inward and downward. And as long as she was setting up a counter wave of just giving and giving and giving, then what happened was she was gradually outrunning that karma. I tended to think of it like race cars, like this. You know, there's the tendency to be self-concerned and all of that that it brings. And then there's this desire to be, to set your energy in motion in an expansive way. And the two run neck and neck. And you just keep trying to give energy into the more universal attitude. And also, you know, what pulls us down? These are the things that Swami talks about. Fear, confusion, doubt. All of these different things that say I can't do it. Whereas in fact, we're perfectly capable of doing it. There was Sudarshan told this story once, a true story about, he really likes, Sudarshan is a man who lives at Ananda Village. He lived here for a while. He's a big, strong fellow, and he really likes the wilderness. He especially likes deserts for some reason. And he used to live out in the desert at various times in his life. And once he was helping some old desert codger, as he called him, just some old guy who lived out in the desert, a real desert rat. He was working for him and helping him. And this desert rat wanted to, this man wanted to, he had an old box car or flat car, railroad car, and he wanted to use it to build a bridge over this ravine. And Sudarshan, who's a big man, but he looked at him and he said, there's just two of us, how are we going to move this? And the old guy said, brute force and sheer ignorance was his response. And in fact, they did. He said, we're just not going to believe we can't, and therefore we're going to do it. You know, and I often laugh because I feel like a lot of what Ananda has accomplished has been brute force and sheer ignorance. Just like the thought never really seriously crossed our minds that we couldn't. And as a consequence, we've been able to do it. Now, that is the power of recognizing that, let's see, this is how it all begins to come together. This is the word faith. You have the faith, and when you have the faith, you're working with an energy and a will that's already there. And you have the clarity of purpose that one creates by constantly, in every small way that you can think of, setting up a counter wave to whatever our contractive waves are. Swami says you set up a single-minded intention, which you can only do when you're not thinking about yourself, because then you're working with that energy and will that's there. And you have the faith in the goodness of what you're doing. Now, there's lots of different elements in how you build this. I know when we just celebrated on Monday the 20th anniversary of getting the property where our community is now. We don't own it, we just lease it. But that was the day it was purchased for the purpose of leasing it to us. And when we were thinking about trying to find an apartment complex that we could convert into a community, we asked Swami Kriyananda sort of, how should we pray about this? And at that, now there are several of these communities in California and on the West Coast, but when we had the idea of doing it, it didn't exist yet. It was a new idea. There was Ananda Village where they owned the property and are developing a country community, but to do what we've since done here was not common yet. And so we asked Swamiji, you know, how do we consider this? How do we pray for this? And his answer was very helpful. He said, self-evidently, it's a good idea. You know, you're devotees, you want to live together. Master said you should have communities. We were living then in several large group houses, which was just too limited a form. Self-evidently, it's a good idea. He said, you don't have to stop and keep asking God, is this a good idea? Self-evidently, it's a good idea. He said, so just commit yourself to going forward to making it happen. And then there was just this feeling in us, all of us, that we were doing a good thing for the right reasons. I mean, one has to be self-honest and one has to be attentive. But once you know that you're doing a good thing for the right reasons and you have support of people who are wiser than you, and it's always a good idea to get the support of people who are wiser than you, it's not a good idea at the beginning, especially, to sail out too strongly just because you think it's a good idea. Because as Swamiji said to me so beautifully once,
Whenever your ego gets involved, you make really bad decisions. Because I have sailed out thinking it was self-evidently a good idea when it wasn't a good idea. It was just my idea at that point. But then he said, just, you know, it's self-evidently a good idea. Just set your minds to do it. And we had a point in that negotiation, just to tell that story since I've started it. That property cost $5 million at the time. Now it costs three times that, four times that. It was a deal at $5 million. 5 acres. And it was bought by a group of what we call sympathetic investors. You know, somebody put together a real estate deal with a bunch of other people's money, because we didn't and don't have that kind of money. And but we had to commit ourselves. We were, you know, many of the investors were us. And we had this one night where we had to commit $100,000. And if we couldn't raise the rest of the money, we would lose that $100,000. And it was the first juncture where real money was at stake. Up until then, you could just play with it. If we withdrew, it didn't matter. And we just didn't have the money. And we had kept writing all the numbers on the board. Rick was there. We kept writing all the numbers on the board, and they just didn't add up. They didn't add up even close. And most of us wore glasses at that time. We've mostly since had LASIK surgery, but we wore glasses, and it just wasn't adding up. We kept trying to make it add up. And finally, we had this idea, and we all backed up, and we took off our glasses, and we looked at it. It looked a lot better. And we had this tremendous faith that we knew it was a good thing and that it was going to work. And we put our hands together. At Ananda, sometimes we say Om Swaha, which means I cast myself into the fire of the infinite. And we said, okay, if we go down, we all go down together. I mean, we didn't have $100,000 to lose on this project. Okay, if we all go down together, we put our hands together and we just went Om Swaha like that. And we declared ourselves as determined and we committed ourselves. A few days later, a man that we hardly knew, who we had no idea had any money, said, oh, I own three houses in San Jose. I can just sell those and put the money into the property. And that was it. And until recently, that man was one of our main owners. He's now since sold out, but sold his share. But you know, there was a feeling to that. There was a sense of rightness. But that rightness was based, that rightness was not presumption. That was based on the fact that already for years in this area, we had been working on a steady, constant, positive, outward-going, expansive energy, you know, constantly contradicting fatigue and fear and narrowness and self-concern and I don't particularly want to do this and why am I here and I'd rather be somewhere else, you know, just all of those energies, but not in a giant gesture. That last gesture was a big one, but we'd worked our way up to it. We'd worked our way up to it on a day by day by day. You know, karma is reversed by the same way it was created. I mean, you can reverse it with conscious will, what we've created by, you know, sheer stupidity. But it's reversed on a moment by moment by moment basis. You know, the decision to be generous, the decision to be energetic, the decision to think first of others, the decision to keep one's mind off of one's own opportunistic self. All of these energies, don't be even slightly discouraged. You'll be astounded what you can do, you know, once that commitment is made. Okay. Is that good enough? All right. I think I'm not quite finished with lesson two. You may start reading lesson three if you like, but I think probably most week will still be on lesson two. So, thank you all very much.